Good day and welcome to Letters in Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. Today we're going to dive into the intellectual and theological underpinnings of Martin Luther King Jr.'s work, and in particular, the social gospel, which came from the 19th century and which included humanistic and socialistic views of Christianity. Our guest is Gary Dorian. He is the Reinhold Niebuhr Professor of Social Ethics at Union Theological Seminary and Professor of Religion at Columbia University. He is the author of the book, Breaking White Supremacy, Martin Luther King Jr. and the Black Social Gospel. Gary Dorian, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you to this program.
Thanks, Mitch. It's a delight for me to be with you.
So we're going to dive in. I'm excited to have this conversation because we're going to dive into the intellectual history behind MLK. And today we remember Martin Luther King Jr. as a moral leader, which he was. We remember him for civil disobedience. And we remember him for his very passionate and powerful speeches. It's also important to remember, though, when we say his name, there's a doctor before it, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. He had a PhD in theology. You know, a few months ago, I read his, his letter from a Birmingham jail, and he writes this letter in a jail cell. But the citations he uses and the quotes throughout history from basically Socrates all the way up to the current day of his day, I would have thought that he would have wrote this letter with the access to a library.
Right. It was all in his head. Well, he had a freshly minted PhD when the Montgomery strike started. In fact, when he went to Montgomery, he's right out of Boston University. He hadn't even quite finished his dissertation, so he actually wrote that dissertation during his first year of ministry in Montgomery. And then along came the bus strike, and King, up till that point, had no activist experience whatsoever. He doesn't have any movement experience because, you know, he was 15 years old when he went to Morehouse College. And then from there he goes to Crozier Seminary, and from there he went to Boston University to do his PhD. So he is purely a product of his home, which of course his father was a pastor, and then this academic experience. So his head is chock full of all these personalist arguments that he wrote his dissertation about. He could have gone even deeper into the weeds. There are ways of reading that letter where you realize, oh my goodness, he could have gone much further down into even what he wrote about in that dissertation than he did in the letters.
What was his dissertation about?
Give you a kind of journalistic version.
Yeah, what was his dissertation about?
It was about, he navigated between the theology of Paul Tillich and Henry Nelson Wyman, two major theologians of his time, who talk about the role of personality in theology, and both of them are giving sort of impersonal renderings of God language and the idea of the divine. And King is defending the personalist sort of idea that that personality is really the key to a trope from any sort of theological perspective, because the infinite value and personality of every human being and of God is his mainstay. If the image of God in every human being is real, then racism is just distinctly evil, and it's distinctly evil on Christian grounds. So that's the argument he defends in this dissertation, and it's in that principle, personalist theological basis is actually in every King sermon and political rally speech that he ever gave.
This is the intellectual formation. This is the intellectual structure underneath him, I guess.
That's right.
What is the Black Social Gospel?
Well, as I mentioned a moment ago, King didn't have any movement activist experience per se when he entered the ministry, but he had the idea of having a social justice ministry because he grew up in the Black Social Gospel. I mean, his father is a Black Social Gospel pastor, and King's mentors, every one of them, is a major figure in what really should be called the Black Social Gospel. Benjamin Mays at Morehouse and J. Pius Barber at Crozier Seminary, and then he gets to Boston Boston University, and Walter Mulder and Harold DeWolf and all these people, they're all white social gospelers at BU. So the social gospel, you know, it's on the white church side, it's famous because it created the whole ecumenical movement, and it's where all those peace and justice fellowships in all the churches sort of came from. And on the across the color line in the black churches, there is a social gospel forming as well. And the social gospel starts up at the same time. It's historically complex. There are lots of sort of causes to it. But on both sides of the color line, but especially in the black churches, more than anything, it's the next phase of the abolition movement. I mean, that's why I called an earlier volume that I wrote in the Black Social Gospel, The New Abolition, because in a nutshell, that's what it is. It's this terrible moment in the late 1870s, early 1880s, when black church pastors have to ask themselves the terrible question, what would a new abolitionism be? I mean, now that abolition has come and gone, and slavery's come and gone, and even now even Reconstruction has come and gone, and we're still in this terrible situation of trauma, or now they're obliterating the 14th and 15th Amendments, and you've got a rampage of mania of lynching going on, which is really just terrorism to enforce the racial caste system. In that sort of terrible context, when, you know, your dream of abolition has already come and gone, and now what would new abolition be need to be in this context? That's where the Black Social Gospel comes from.
And you mentioned the ecumenical movement.
Sure.
If I understand this correctly, the word itself, ecumenical, means to bring together?
That's right. And it's the ecumenical movement, it's institutionalized in what became the Federal Council of Churches, which was organized, founded in 1908, and it was the predecessor organization to what became the National Council of Churches after World War II. So at the outset, the Federal Council of Churches is, you know, it's 33 Protestant denominations and the Eastern Orthodox Church pulling together. I mean, they can't agree about doctrine. You know, that's why you have all these churches, is they don't agree about doctrine, but the idea is we should be able to work together to do some real work in society.
So does that mean bringing together all churches, all Christian churches, whether it's Catholic, Protestant?
Well, that was the dream. Now, of course, you always have to start somewhere. It's like Social Security. You know, you don't start with the whole thing. You start with what you can get, and then you keep sort of making it better over time. And that's the way the ecumenical movement was. I mean, they wanted very much to have ecumenism reach to the Catholic Church. And then beyond that, you know, relations between Christianity and Judaism and other religions. And that is, so there's always sort of this dream of a greater ecumenism that does occur, you know, over time. But it has to start somewhere, and where it started was with these Protestant social gospelers who just said, it's even if we can't agree about doctrine, we should be able to band together to do something about a living wage and decent working conditions and what they called, you know, it was called the social creed, which the Federal Council of Churches barely existed for a month when it puts out this something called the Social Creed of the Churches. And it had 14 bullet points, and one of them was a living wage for everyone, and another one was complete justice for all people, period.
And that's the social gospel?
That's the social gospel. The social gospel is saying, and it starts in the 1880s, it comes up at the very same time as sociology, and there's just a whole new sort of grammar that's being spoken of. You know, that social, there's such a thing as social justice. There's such a thing as social structure. And so the social gospel movement is saying if people suffer because of politics and economics, then the church has to deal with politics and economics. The church has a social mission to transform the structures of society in the direction of social justice. That involves a kind of trajectory and an ethical, it's giving an ethical meaning to the faith, and it really didn't have before as a social justice component. That's the social gospel in a nutshell. And it existed in the white churches and in historic black churches. And, of course, ecumenically, these two things overlapped. I mean, they worked together.
Who was Walter Rauschenbusch? Rauschenbusch, if I'm saying his name correctly. Walter Rauschenbusch.
Walter Rauschenbusch was the greatest exponent of the white social gospel. Of course, he didn't put it that way. He just said, you know, the social gospel. But he was a professor at Rochester Seminary. His father had been a well-known Baptist educator teaching at the seminary. And he wrote an electrifying work advocating Christian socialism, that is, economic democracy and the social gospel, in 1907, titled Christianity and the Social Crisis. And that is the benchmark text of the entire social gospel movement. It's just the year before the Federal Council of Churches was formed. All these black social gospel figures that I write about in the New Abolition and then in Breaking White Supremacy, they could all quote Rauschenbusch. Just from memory, as King could. Martin Luther King was deeply influenced by Rauschenbusch's work, including just the fact that Rauschenbusch is the figure representing Christian socialism to him, and that's, you know, King identifies with that tradition, as did his mentors, you know, Mays and Mordecai Johnson and Howard Thurman and others like that, J. Pius Barber.
Yeah, and when you say socialism, you mean socialism as we mean it today.
Yes, well, it's a social democratic tradition of, you know, economic democracy. It's anti-communist. It's usually willing, you know, to deal with a mixed economy. But it's like it's in the tradition of the social democratic, you know, parties and traditions in Europe. Of course, Rauschenbusch was very much involved and aware of those traditions in Europe. He was as much German as he was American, almost as much anyway. So there was a real conversation between what was called Christian socialism in England and also in Germany and what was usually called the social gospel in the United States, although there is a flank of the social gospel in the United States that was just explicitly Christian socialist. And in fact, in a broad sense of the term, the entire social gospel was Christian socialist in the sense that all social gospelers believe that we need to expand the cooperative sector and we need to nationalize what they called natural monopolies. When you're in a business like the railroad industry that just inevitably ends up becoming a monopoly, that needs to be taken over to serve the public good. And as much as possible, you want to sort of expand that sector of the economy that doesn't belong wholly to the capitalist market or to the state. There's got to be some kind of mediating space here where we can have sort of decentralized forms of socialization that we promote, you know, cooperatives and mixed forms of worker and community ownership and so on. Virtually the entire social gospel is on for that sort of agenda.
What was their backlash against the social gospel and Rauschenbusch?
There's always a backlash. Yeah. Yes. That's why these books are as long as they are that I wrote about this, because
it is a long one.
Almost all of these social gospel leaders, especially in the founding generations, they all have a battle on their hands, not just, you know, in the politics of the time, but within their own churches. I mean, to any time you're saying a new thing in a religious context and saying we need to take on some burden that we didn't take on before, it's to our shame if we don't. You know, you're going to have a fight in the churches. These founding pastors, especially on the white side, they are shamed by trade union organizers who say there's simply no evidence that the Christian churches care at all about poor and vulnerable people. And people like Walter Rauschenbusch knew it was true. I mean, they just stood convicted, and they thought it's pointless to try to defend Christianity if the churches are taking an indefensible attitude on that issue. And so that's the motivating force of the social gospel broadly. And of course, in a black church context, what always trumps even that issue is just the fact of just sheer outright racial terrorism and the racial caste system in which the gospel, you know, in which church people need to be involved in building a protest movement and social justice and protest politics to push back against, you know, what's happening living in the dominant society. So you always have a fight on your hands. I only have one person in this entire story who didn't have a battle within his own church, his own denomination, and that was Alexander Walters. But all the others did, including Martin Luther King, because, you know, King's own denomination opposed the civil rights movement. That's the National Baptist Convention. And he had to, you know, his group finally had to break away from it in 1962, because, you know, he is in a denomination that is against what he is doing.
Let's begin to connect the line from Rauschenbusch to Martin Luther King Jr. and the people in between. And sure. Let's begin with somebody you already mentioned, Mordecai Wyatt Johnson, who would become the first African-American president of Howard University. Mordecai Wyatt Johnson studied under Walter Rauschenbusch.
That's right.
At the Rochester Theological Seminary School.
Yes, that's right. Well, he went to Morehouse College, where Morehouse and Howard University are the two black institutions that are sort of foremost in this whole social gospel story. They have social gospel identities in a way that are just a standout, although there are a number of other institutions, but those are the two that are foremost. So Mordecai Johnson went to Morehouse College, and then later he goes to Rochester Seminary, where he studied under Rauschenbusch himself. So he got this social gospel idea, and just the way how you understand scripture and what the church is supposed to be involved in, he takes right there from Rauschenbusch, but always in his own sort of black church context. So needing to translate it, you know, to a black church context, becomes a pastor from the beginning. Johnson is a spellbinder out on the YMCA, YWCA student Christian movement lecture circuit, because the YMCA has a considerable role in this whole social gospel story. And Johnson's early career is out on that lecture circuit, speaking to mixed race audiences, and expounding, you know, promoting the social gospel. So Johnson is a major figure who is a mentor, and he's inspiring, and he's a role model, not just to King, and he definitely was that to King, but to a number of folks in this story, and then he goes on to become the first black president of Howard University. Johnson might have painted an even sort of larger figure on kind of the national sort of canvas had he not been so absorbed by, you know, needing to build up Howard University, because it was still, he's the one who built it into what it was. It had a very, you know, an important story. It had been an important institution for, you know, more than half a century when he got it there. But he's the one who built it into this great thing that it became. And so, you know, once you've got everyday tasks to hold a university together and build it up, you can't have quite the national reach that he otherwise would have had. But he's out there every week building this social gospel. So he's a mentor and a role model to everybody else in what became my, you know, volume two story called Breaking White Supremacy, and certainly King was one of them.
This is Letters in Politics, and today we are in conversation about the intellectual and theological underpinnings of the work of Martin Luther King Jr. Our guest is Gary Dorian. He is the Reinhold Niebuhr Professor of Social Ethics at Union Theological Seminary and also a professor of religion at Columbia University. He is the author of the book Breaking White Supremacy, Martin Luther King Jr. and the Black Social Gospel. Mordecai Johnson would actually end up having a heart-to-heart talk with Walter Rauschenbusch about race.
Many historians for a long time got this wrong about the white social gospel, just thought that it didn't even have any real conscience about race and racism. And a lot of them, all they knew was, you know, a couple of books by Rauschenbusch, and he didn't talk about it. And so they have this, got this idea that there was not, there was no real connection between the white social gospel and the struggle for racial justice. And that was never right, although it was naming something that was important. Rauschenbusch went for years in which he did not write about racism. And the reason when he finally, you know, admitted later on why it was, he just said it was just, he just found the issue of racism in this country to be just so deep and depressing and overwhelming that he just, he couldn't even imagine how he would blend that into these books about the forward sort of march of the kingdom of God on in history, you know, that he's trying to inspire people to change society, and he just can't imagine how he can deal with this subject in a way that isn't going to be deflating and just bring people down. And that's his own sort of personal issue for some years. Now, you know, by the end of his life, he does admit, yeah, that was wrong. So we have in a couple of his later books, I mean, he will write about racism, about the terrible blight of racism in American society. And at the very end, in his last book, Theology for the Social Gospel, he even he talks about lynching as the ultimate example of what he calls the kingdom of evil. That is how it is that an evil can be instantiated in a society and then passed on through ethos and social structure and just becomes insinuated into the culture such that if you grow up in that culture, you are infected by that evil. And that, you know, Rauschenbusch does write about lynching as being exactly that's what has happened in America in his time. But his early books do not go on about that at all, because, you know, he's trying to pump up this forward marching optimistic social gospel, and racism doesn't fit into that narrative at all. Johnson studied under Rauschenbusch at just the time when Rauschenbusch is having to fess up to what is wrong in his early work. And of course, for Johnson, that job of translation, of translating the social gospel in that he got from Rauschenbusch and others into a black church vernacular, that's always his work.
Another fun fact, and I learned this by spending time last night with your book about Mordecai Johnson. And Mordecai, the name itself was important to Mordecai Johnson, because if I recall correctly, Mordecai was a Jewish leader in the Bible during when the Jews were under Persian rule.
That's right.
If I believe. Yeah. But that, as you mentioned earlier, he was at the Black College Morehouse. But then, which was very common for people during this time when they went to black universities, they would end up going also to a white university at least for a year, because they thought that would give them a little more, I guess, credence in society at the time. So he went to the University of Chicago. He was warned about the University of Chicago because there they taught socialism and evolution.
That's
and
right.
The story you tell, as soon as he got to the University of Chicago, he had to take three classes, and he didn't know what to do with the third class, but the first two classes he signed up for were on evolution and socialism.
Right. Yeah.
So he had this before he started studying under Rauschenbusch.
Yes, that is so. Well, they call it validated. You know, you would go to Chicago to get your degree validated. And it's especially black Baptists who would do this, because the University of Chicago is a Baptist institution. And the University of Chicago, you know, was open to them. So in the course of a regular sort of academic year, you know, from September to May, there are only three or four black students at the University of Chicago Divinity School. But in the summers, it would swell to, you know, upwards of 100 black students. That is, most of these folks are pastors already or on their way to becoming either pastors or academics. And they would go to Chicago during, since, of course, Chicago was on the quarter system, so you could get a whole, you know, semester or a quarter in during the summer. And many people took that road, sort of getting some piece of their education at the University of Chicago, which, of course, was one of the citadels of the social gospel. People like Shaler Matthews taught there. And also at Chicago, Chicago is very important for being the place where we really sort of broke free from this kind of mechanistic way of thinking about how the natural sciences translate to the social sciences. I mean, Herbert Spencer was the towering intellectual in this country and in England in the 1870s and 1880s. And there you've got a very mechanistic idea of how whatever you know about evolutionary biology, you just sort of translate to the social order. And so, you know, social Darwinism is all the rage. And that's one way of understanding what the social gospel is. Social gospel is an opposition movement against social Darwinism. And there's an extraordinary thing about it, because at the very these very same social gospelers who are having to convince the churches that we have to deal with Darwinism, you know, that Darwinism as evolutionary theory is just true, and we just have to deal with it and accept it on its terms. But at some point, there is some line that you cross that we have to absolutely say no to, that social Darwinism is morally repugnant. It can't be right. So at the very same time, at the churches, when these social gospelers are having to tell the churches, we got to deal with Darwinism, they're also saying, but we have to say no to social Darwinism. And that's about as much for any generation as, you know, any movement I know of to have on its plate.
And of course, there are still many churches at the time that didn't want you learning about evolution. Hence, this is why Mordecai Johnson was being warned not to go to the University of Chicago, or at least be careful once he got there.
That's right.
What about Martin Luther King Jr.? Was his views similar as Mordecai Johnson when it came to science?
King is exactly the same way. Is exactly. You know, King's father does not value higher education the way people like Benjamin Mays and Mordecai Johnson and others do. But King's Daddy King does recognize that, you know, the son has got good mentors here. And so every time he says, I need one more degree, Daddy King is willing to, you know, cut a check and help him go, even though, you know, he really didn't want him to go to BU. He thought Morehouse was enough. And then when he goes to Crozier, oh, well, you need that. Okay, after that, now he wants him to come join him in his ministry. So King has these mentors for whom the life of mind, of a certain kind of intellectualism and a certain kind of social justice-oriented ministry just go together. They need to go together. And everybody that he respects, looks up to, is a mind of that very thing. And so, as I say, you know, King did not come from nowhere.
Yeah.
He is in a tradition of these black social gospel pastors who prize the life of the mind of modern knowledge, of intellectualism, and of a kind of social justice way of understanding this social mission of the faith itself.
Well, speaking of Martin Luther King Jr., Junior's father, Senior, and also MLK Jr.'s sort of role models or people that helped guided him. One of them was a good friend of MLK Jr.'s father, and that's Howard Thurman.
Yes,
who I find to be a really fascinating person, a serious mystic.
Sir Thurman is an extraordinary figure. He is a person with a deep mystical faith. He is a mystic for years before he even has a language for it, which somewhat, you know, set him apart in his earlier life, because, you know, how do I talk about this? He doesn't have anyone really sort of confirming him in it. Doesn't really know how to talk about it, and yet he does have this sort of deep sort of sense of a kind of mystic connection to all things and the interrelation of all things.
I would almost compare him to, if we were talking about Islam, to a Sufi.
Oh, yes, yeah. Very much so. It's similar kind of wavelengths. And
was he a Gnostic?
Thurman, when he meets mystics from other religious traditions, then from the rest of his life, he is able to have a very quick rapport with people of a similar kind of experience.
But was he a Gnostic?
No, it's not Gnosticism work. You know, Gnosticism is always about a kind of a dualism of worlds, and where there's a better world out there somewhere, a spirit world, and now we're condemned to this, this world of materiality, which is inferior and created and needs to be looked down on. He's what he, Thurman called his mysticism affirmative mysticism. That is worldly, affirming, which is language that he got from someone who was an important mentor to him in all this, which is Rufus Jones, the great Quaker mystical theologian. But Thurman, in the 30s and 40s, early 40s anyway, certainly all through the 30s, Gandhi is active in India, and people are saying, where's our Gandhi? Where is that saintly type who could be our Gandhi? And there were plenty of people who said, well, that's, we know who it should be. It should be Howard Thurman, because he seems to have everything to play that kind of role. But for Thurman, political activism, there was something crude about political activism that he could just never really cotton to, and he didn't want to be a political leader. That means holding together coalitions and just doing a certain kind of work that just isn't him at all. So he always is putting it off. But he is out there speaking all the time, and he's Howard Thurman, so people can see it in him, and they want him to play, to be the Gandhi figure. So it ended up surprising everybody that it was a young Baptist minister with no activist experience at all who ended up becoming the American Gandhi.
Well, it was Howard Thurman, isn't it, that would sort of be a bridge from Gandhi to Martin Luther King Jr.?
Yes, King sees it in Thurman, treasures it, and he carried one of Thurman's book, Jesus and the Disinherited, with him. He had a very well-worn copy. There are snatches of Thurman, that come up in King's sermons, and a number of them. And of course, King's barrel of sermons, pretty much the whole barrel existed by the end of his first year of ministry, and he just riffed on it for the rest of his career, because he's in motion out there speaking hundreds of times a year. So he's constantly updating this barrel of sermons that he had. But he only had really that first year at Montgomery to be an every week preacher writing new sermons. And there are snatches in those sermons where he's drawing on Thurman. Also, of course, he had known Thurman during his own graduate school years, because Thurman ended his career as chaplain at Boston University, where King did his doctorate. So King had heard Thurman preach there and did look up to him as a figure from that earlier generation who kind of modeled this social gospel way of understanding the faith and living it. But with Thurman, there's always this little bit of an exception, because he is a mystic. He's not like Benjamin Mays, and he's not like Mordecai Johnson. He formed a social gospel trio with those two at Howard University through the 30s. But those two, Mays and Johnson, they have no, they are fully committed to a very sort of political social justice ministry. I mean, to either of them, a speech is just a wasted opportunity if you don't make the case for racial justice and what needs to be happening right now. And Thurman was never really interested in giving that kind of a talk.
We are in conversation about the theological and philosophical underpinnings of the work of Martin Luther King Jr. Our guest is Gary Dorian. He is the Reinhold Niebuhr Professor of Social Ethics at Union Theological Seminary, and he's also a professor of religion at Columbia University. He is the author of the book, Breaking White Supremacy, Martin Luther King Jr. and the Black Social Gospel. You've brought up the name a few times of Benjamin Mays, Benjamin E. Mays. Perhaps, yes. I should ask you, who is he? And what it, and the importance of him towards the development of MLK.
Yes, this is somebody who grew up in South Carolina, totally disenfranchised for most of his life, grows up not even imagining that a friendship with a white person is just, impossible, is a possibility on this earth. is determined to get an education, which involves, he needs finally to break with his father when he's, you know, in his late teens, because he's coming from the part of the world where you're just hooked into an agricultural cycle, and just in order to survive, you know, you have to work in the fields, and he's desperate to get an education, so he claws his way to an education, even gets himself all the way up to Bates College, finally way up there in Maine, to finish his degree. Then from there goes to the University of Chicago, where he earns a PhD in theology. So this is one of these people who's just fiercely determined not to let white society just so beat him down that he can't, you know, he can't have the kind of ministry and career that he's got in his head. So he's one of these sort of prototypes of the black social gospel. Just after he finished his PhD at Chicago, Mordecai Johnson brought him to Howard. So he had his run, his years teaching with Johnson and Thurman at Howard University, where they, during the very time when Johnson built Howard University into a powerhouse. So there was this period in the 1930s when Howard University just sort of had a monopoly on all the great black scholars in this country just across the fields. And he built the law school into, you know, the institution that basically took on the Supreme Court and, you know, got one court case after another that, you know, takes you eventually to Brown versus Board of Education decision. So Howard is an enormously important institution, and Mays was there during its sort of glory years in the 30s of building it into what it was. And then Morehouse College called him. Actually, they asked Thurman first for Thurman to come and be president. Thurman didn't want to run Morehouse College.
He's a mystic.
So then they turned around and asked Mays, and he did do it. So then he had this long run as president of Morehouse College. And Morehouse has had a bunch of great presidents, but Mays is still the special one out of that whole run. And, of course, he was president there in the 40s when King was a student there. And so for King, listening to Mays in, you know, give a chapel address every week, that is a deeply formative experience. And it also, he's something of another father figure. I mean, King loves his own father, but, you know, Mays in some ways is more like it's all there with Mays. The intellectualism, the commitment to a certain kind of social justice politics, a theological progressivism. You know, King called his father a fundamentalist for his whole career. It's not quite fair, but, you know, that does say something, that there's some alienation between the father and the son with regard to how the theology is sort of construed. And Mays is much more his sort of exemplar. So Mays is a very important figure in this whole story.
And there are many more people we could talk about. And in fact, before we wrap up, I want to bring up Pauli Murray. We've done shows on Pauli Murray, and I think it's important and fascinating. But before we get to Pauli Murray, looking at Benjamin Mays, Howard Thurman, and Mordecai Wyatt Johnson, the three people we've really focused on concerning the black social gospel, did Martin Luther King Jr.'s work, obviously it was built upon their work and their ideas, did it advance beyond what they already laid out?
Yes. King himself, you know, King's already famous in the 1950s, and even he isn't, you know, there's a lot of talk about Gandhian disruption, but he didn't actually do any until after SNCC is formed in 1960, and now, you know, young people are getting arrested, because King is peaceable and deeply kindly, and the idea that he's going to lead people into getting harmed, getting killed, that really tied him up in the late 1950s. He gave, you know, fabulous speeches, was, and they did, you know, the boycott in Montgomery was a success, but then they really got stuck in the late 50s. So it's only in the early 60s that King is able to kind of face up to what this is going to mean, that he's got to be willing to sort of lead a movement in which you're going into just the most hateful cities you can find and raising hell in them, and maybe getting people injured and maybe getting them killed, and that's what it's going to take. And of course, that is a step beyond any of his mentors. I mean, they did not do that. Not only that, but, you know, his own home, the headquarters, is in Atlanta, and they never did. They didn't really do this stuff in Atlanta. And that's partly because the pressure of people like Mays, who just said, you don't do that here. You know, we'll take care of Atlanta. So there is something of an ethos of a kind of black aristocracy in Atlanta itself that King has to be able to get beyond, including sort of just getting beyond sort of the influence of his own father, who's still sort of a major figure in Atlanta. For example, as early as you can get, back in Montgomery in the bus boycott in 1956, Mays at first was siding with Daddy King, who said, you know, come home. You know, it's not worth getting thrown in prison in Montgomery. And it was King had a conscience about that. He said, I couldn't live with myself if I were to, you know, cut and run from this struggle. I've got to see this through. Now, Mays, to his credit, then did see, oh, you know, the younger King is right. And so Mays, you know, got on the right side of it. But that's just that right there, sort of telling of how, you know, King is having to move beyond even what any of his mentors did. Now, Johnson does cheer him every step of the way. I mean, Johnson never puts up any opposition to, he never says to him, oh, you're going too fast or anything like that. But King does accelerate the pace. I mean, he ends up doing things, and especially at the end. You know, at the end, King was the most radical person in all of it, in the whole SCLC. I mean, he dragged SCLC to Chicago. He dragged him into the Poor People's Campaign at the end. He had the entire executive staff against him. So by the end, King is more out there, more radical than even James Bevel, which is his usual barometer of going too far.
What was behind his radicalism?
The sheer limits of, you know, how little you've actually changed when you pass a civil rights bill and a voting rights act, it got to King that we've come nowhere near breaking white supremacy. I mean, white supremacy as a structure of power based on privilege that presumes to define what's normal and that holds, you know, the vast majority of black people down and doesn't take any real responsibility for the accumulated consequences of 246 years of slavery and 100 years of Jim Crow and just what that ends up meaning for black Americans. To King, it just weighs on him in the early 60s, mid-60s, of just how the sheer weight of that and how little actually has changed in American society, even though they've won these spectacular, you know, victories. And when he would talk like this, you know, people like Andy Young would be, you know, get upset with him, say, oh, please, you know, look, we've been incredibly successful here. You know, why you can't take on the burden of all of American history, you know, on one little organization. And for King, no, he does bear it. This is why he can never take a vacation or just take a break from it. He just feels so deeply the burden of confronting, interrogating the consequences, the ravages of American racism and white supremacy. And he's, you know, he's just doing everything he can to try to break through, to try to build a culture of atonement in this country for what it is that, you know, this country has done.
I want to end on Pauli Murray again. And we've done programs about Pauli Murray. Pauli Murray, if people listen to the show frequently enough, they'll know that she presented as a law student at the time, what would become the legal underpinnings for overturning Brown versus Board of Education. She would become a very important legal mind in the world in the second half of the 20th century. The ideas of intersectionality today, you could probably trace back to Pauli Murray. Pauli Murray is somebody born female, but would identify as a male, didn't have the language that we do today to call himself a transgender, but would identify as a male later on in life. Also became a minister.
That's right.
Can you talk to me about that last part? When we did a show on Pauli Murray, we didn't really talk about the religious aspect a whole lot.
Well, you know, near the end of her life, in her last year, she wrote an autobiography, and the book didn't really come together. And it was only then that she started to realize, oh, the reason this book isn't coming together the way, say, my earlier book, Proud Jews, did, is that I still don't really understand the meaning of my life. She only came into it at the end. The age of 63, she leaves her chair at Brandeis University, which she had, you know, desperately coveted for years, leaves that in order to go to General Theological Seminary in New York in order to become an Episcopal priest, because it turns out, I mean, she as she came to realize that she was on a spiritual journey all these years and really didn't know it, didn't realize that spirituality that was in her was the actual sort of story of her life. And it wasn't just the politics, and it wasn't just, you know, the legal arguments and all that, and a struggle for civil rights and the like.
And is it the social gospel that she's clinging to?
Very much. I mean, of course, you know, the social gospel can be understood just as sort of in political terms, right? She was always with that and trying to get, you know, let inside, because she's always knocking on the door. You know, when I wrote the first draft of Breaking White Supremacy, I had Pauli Murray in every chapter. And for a while, it was always showing what got her shut out this time or that time, you know, because she's always there. She's alone of all her sex at, you know, at Howard Law School in 1943, and is just always there and yet always being shut out. So for a while, I've got her in every chapter, but then I thought, that's shutting her out as well. So I ended up holding till the very last chapter, and then putting her entire story in the last chapter and making it a commentary on the entire book, you know, that just transpired. And that allows me to sort of catch up with her, because it's only in the latter part of her life, when she's willing to give up her coveted academic chair, that she realizes, no, I have been on a spiritual journey. Now, one of the things that kept her from realizing it was that she was Episcopalian. And so she's got this, you know, she's in a clerical church, and she's got sort of a clerical idea about what religious people are like. You know, it's churchy, and they're ministers. And being Episcopalian means she can't be a minister, except that, of course, that changed just in time for her. So there she is at the age of 63, finally, studying.
And had to fight for
General Seminary.
Yeah.
And, of course, then become a priest, and has spent the latter part of her life as an Episcopal priest.
We're almost out of time, but I kind of want to get you to reflect on this point. And that's why I thought it was important to talk about Pauli Murray here at the end, because I think Pauli Murray, when we think about the ideas today of intersectionality, you can trace these to Pauli Murray. I think they're one of the legal philosophy that inspired, whether it be gay and lesbian and transgender right movements, if it would be movements for people with disabilities, whatever it is, it was Pauli Murray's work. And also, Pauli Murray would say this, that this should be applied in other places or through society. That makes me think of today. And just as one little example would be Black Lives Matter, which is very much pretty much a secular movement. But that said, it's very steeped in intersectionality thought. But I can't help seeing, and not just Black Lives Matter, but almost all the social justice movements today, and just, you know, the social justice issues, this is all very much connected and rooted in the Black social gospel.
Yes. Yes, that's right. That's one concern I have, is just to sort of convey how much that is the case. We have to deal with the kind of stereotype about what this was, that it's something that's, you know, that doesn't resonate. And even, you know, the imagery we have about King and who he was, you know, if you really understand who King was, he's so much more resonant and relevant than it seems. Because he isn't just this, you know, icon of white liberalism, which what we turned him into for so long. Murray is someone who I think radiates to the present day as brilliantly as ever, because she's always about talking about the way these different sites and types of oppression intersect, and you just can't break it ever down to kind of one factor or anything, that life is morally complex and there are different ways in which people and groups are oppressed, and there are ways in which some people who are themselves oppressed also will function as oppressors to others, and that has to be sort of be named for what it is, and you need sort of tools to be able to talk about how that works. And so that sort of aspect of her work, which isn't just her work, of course, that's just the story of her own life, going through a whole career where she spent years wondering, what am I being excluded? What's the reason I'm being excluded for this time? Is it because I'm female, or I'm black, or I'm queer, or what? You know, and half the time she didn't know. But working on that was her own life story. Even the issue of being as influenced as she is by white culture and having white people in her family tree, and so she's, you know, mixed race. That itself was plenty to deal with. And I think all of that makes her a figure today that, you know, when I teach her in class, I mean, that's when we get to Pauli Murray, all I have to do is just walk into class. I don't have to worry about how will I get this discussion going, because she just radiates so brilliantly to today's context.
Gary Dorian is the Reinhold Niebuhr Professor of Social Ethics at Union Theological Seminary, also a professor of religion at Columbia University, author of the book Breaking White Supremacy, Martin Luther King Jr. and the Black Gospel. Gary Dorian, thank you for that.
Thank you, Mitch. My pleasure. Thanks very much.